Welcome to the Blue Ocean Church Ann Arbor Lenten Podcast. I'm Emily, one of the co-pastors of Blue Ocean, and this is part 5 of 6. I'll begin by giving you a brief summary of chapter 5 of The Cross and Lynching Tree by James Cone. I'll follow that with a couple of questions to think about during the week, and then end with a time of meditation. Chapter 5 is titled, O Mary, Don't You Weep. And in it, James Cone is capturing and recording some of the pain experienced by Black women in the lynching period. The stories and perspectives of Black women have often been overlooked by academics. Feminist historians seek to include the voices of women in their telling of history. But often Black women have felt left out of that work. And sometimes people will describe that as feeling erased, as if their lens and their experiences were simply banished from the historical record. So in response, a new focus was placed on the particular histories of Black women in a branch of academia called womanism. So if you hear that something is from a feminist perspective, it usually means that it includes the voices and perspectives of women. If you hear that something is a womanist perspective, it particularly means it includes the perspectives of Black women. And it's the womanist stream that James Cone tells us that he's tapping into with this chapter. Because so often when we speak about the lynching period in American history, we think of and we tell the stories of the Black men who were killed. And while it's true that 98% of Black people who were lynched in this period were indeed men, if we focus only on their stories, then we miss the very real and deep pain experienced by the women who knew and who loved them. Cone writes this on page 122. With many historians and sociologists writing about the lynching of Black men, Black women have objected to being invisible in lynching discourse, as if they were exempt from mob violence. Furthermore, when Black men were lynched, Black women not only suffered the loss of their sons, their husbands, their brothers, their uncles, their nephews, and their cousins, but they also endured public insults and economic hardship as they tried to carry on to take care of their fatherless children in a patriarchal and racist society in which whites could lynch them or their children with impunity at the slightest whim or the smallest infraction of the Southern racial etiquette, end quote. Sometimes Black women were substituted for men who ran away from their lynchers, and sometimes Black women were raped. And while it was oh so often that white men raped Black women, white people, both male and female, very often falsely accused Black men of raping white women, a flip-flop of what was actually happening in an exercise that one can only call mass projection of white male sins onto Black men. It was the accusation of a Black man raping a white woman that was the reason given for a lynching in 1 out of 3 cases. After investigating this, Black activist and journalist Ida B. Wells concluded that in many of the cases the claims referred to consensual sexual acts, while in others the claims were just false. So in other words, when a Black man was accused of raping a white woman and then killed for doing so, it was almost always either a false charge or the result of a consensual sexual encounter. Ida Wells lived in Memphis, Tennessee, and Cone leans into her story for a significant portion of the chapter because she was, as he writes, the first person to put her life on the line for the anti-lynching cause. In 1892, she wrote Truth About Lynching, exposing that the rape charges that were used to justify lynching were most often false, following a very real case where that had just happened in her hometown of Memphis. She then wrote an editorial in a paper called The Free Speech that very nearly cost her her life. And the statement in that editorial that particularly enraged whites was this. She said, "Nobody in this section believes the threadbare lie that Negro men assault white women. If Southern men are not careful, they will overreach themselves and public sentiment will have a reaction. A conclusion will then be reached, which will be very damaging to the moral reputation of their women." End quote. The very suggestion that white women might want to sleep with Black men and do so consensually, was enough to ignite a riot in the city. The white men of Memphis destroyed the Free Speech News headquarters, and they ran the editor out of town. And they would have taken Ida's life if she hadn't already been out of town. She was never again able to return to Memphis, and instead relocated to Chicago to continue her work. James Cone asks what it was that empowered and sustained Ida Wells in her work, and then he answers that question with this: her faith in God, which he says that she inherited from her ex-slave parents and from the African-American church community. I quote, he said, "It was a faith defined by the cross and the black cultural resistance to white supremacy." Her faith was not one that let her sit passively by. Cone tells a story that exemplifies her ethos. So in 1919, Ida Wells risked her life by dressing in disguise to go and visit 12 black prisoners who managed to escape a death in an Arkansas race massacre that saw 300 black men killed. And so these other 12 men were locked away, and the men told her that they were waiting on God and reading scriptures and just praying not to die. And Ida said to them, "Why don't you pray to live and to be freed? The God you serve is the God of Paul and Silas, who opened the prison gates. And if you have all the faith you say you have, you ought to believe that he will open your prison doors too." The prisoners were indeed freed after a Supreme Court acquittal. Cone points out that though her faith was bold and strong, she had her moments of doubt, and she had her moments of losing faith in Christianity, and that she held those two items in tandem. Right? She had enough doubt to keep her faith humble, and enough faith to keep her from despair. Nellie Burroughs, the National Baptist leader, lived by a similar set of principles: that faith is important, but without efforts toward justice, faith is useless. In a 1933 sermon at Bethel AME Church in D.C., she said, "Don't wait for deliverers. There are no deliverers. The Negro must serve notice to the world that he is ready to die for justice. We are a race on this continent that can work out its own salvation. Work as if all depends on you. Pray as if all depends on God." Cone points out a number of the many, many women who lived and led in the fight against lynching and white supremacy. And he uses this chapter to talk about how black people utterly rejected white Christianity because the fruit of its teachings were so evidently harmful and hypocritical. He points out that all of the major Christian institutions, meaning white-led, in America at the time, were silent in regards to lynching and segregation. So Cone writes, and I quote, this is a long quote, he says, "Black people did not need to go to seminary and study theology to know that white Christianity was fraudulent. As a teenager in the South, where whites treated blacks with contempt, I and other blacks knew that the Christian identity of whites was not a true expression of what it meant to follow Jesus. We wondered how whites could live with their hypocrisy, such a blatant contradiction of the man from Nazareth. I'm still wondering about that," he writes. White conservative Christianity's blatant endorsement of lynching as a part of its religion and white liberal Christians' silence about lynching placed both of them outside of the Christian identity. I could not find one sermon or theological essay, not to mention a book, opposing lynching by a prominent liberal white preacher. There was no way a community could support or ignore lynching in America while still representing, in word and deed, the one who was lynched in Rome. For Ida B. Wells, Christian identity had to be validated by opposing mob violence against a powerless people, and no amount of theological sophistry could convince her otherwise. As far as she was concerned, white Christianity was a counterfeit gospel," end quote. So if you've read Solus Jesus, the book that Ken and I wrote together, or if you've heard us preach for any amount of time, you know that James Cone and other voices like his have heavily influenced our writing. And you might better understand why it is that we spend so much time talking about resisting false accusations and about mob violence, because too often white privileged pastors have neglected the justice aspects of Scripture, especially when it would cost them socially and professionally. And Cone rightly calls it out. And while we may not have lynch mobs per se in our culture today, we do have a disproportionate number of unarmed black people who die at the hands of armed cops, and a disproportionate number of black people in American jail cells with disproportionately harsher sentences than whites, which is a systemic issue that Union Theological Seminary professor Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow. We also have undocumented immigrants who are held without trial in tent cities, thousands of immigrant children permanently separated from their families, and we have a suffering indigenous population wrangled under reservations. We have trans people, especially trans women of color, who are killed without recourse and who experience incredible violence and discrimination. And we have laws that allow queer people to be fired just for being gay, to be kicked out of their homes, their rental homes, their apartments. Laws that allow adoption agencies to deny that children can be adopted by gay parents. Right? There's so much injustice and scapegoating and mob violence in our culture and in this world. And Cone teaches us that the cross both calls our attention to this unfair violence against our fellow humans and announces its ultimate defeat. Right? The cross reveals the violence and it denounces it. And at the end of the chapter, he reiterates that there's nothing inherently redemptive about suffering. Right? Suffering just sucks. Suffering is tragic. But that there is something redemptive in the cross's declaration that, and I quote, he says, that God snatches victory out of defeat, life out of death, and hope out of despair, as revealed in the biblical and black proclamation of Jesus's resurrection. And when we're tempted to be overwhelmed by the sadness and the injustice of the world, that we can find comfort and hope in knowing that God is on the side of the oppressed, that God stands for the vulnerable, that God is with the vulnerable, and that God calls us to work with her on bringing an end to these injustices, and that our faith does provide a path for validating the dignity and the humanity of every single person and denouncing violence and inhumane treatment, no matter what form that it takes. So especially if you're white, I think Cone offers us a challenge in asking us which Jesus we follow. Do we follow the white Jesus, who was used to justify lynching and allowed for liberal whites to remain silent? Or do we follow black Jesus, the Jesus of the oppressed, who comforts the mourning, who empowers activists, who catalyzes the imaginations of artists so that they can envision a more equitable world, and who gives hope and assurance to those who trust in him? Which view of Jesus is it that we hold to? And with that, I will leave you with a couple of questions to think about, our standard questions. Feel free to pause the podcast to think about it or to discuss in a group. First question, what are one to two things that you learned from this chapter? Second question, where do you feel challenged, stretched, and/or provoked? To close out, we'll take a little time of silence to sit with our thoughts. And during this time, we can ask the Holy Spirit if there's anything that she would like to say to you in this space. You feel free to pause the podcast until you're done, and then I'll have the closing song, Strange Fruit, sung by Billie Holiday, to end the podcast.
Swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. the gallant South. The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolia, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the tree to drop. Here's a strange and bitter cry.